Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, I want to thank you for being here with us. It is not easy out there right now. Much of the news is really tough and a lot of uncertainty around us. But one thing that is certain is the world. We're going to keep bringing you critical reporting on international events, keep highlighting the voices and people at the center of these stories. And we're able to keep doing this because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 30th, we're in fundraising mode. We need to raise $25,000 before the end of the month. If you believe, as we do, in independent, fact-based journalism and in its power to make sense out of the noise and help preserve democracy around the globe, I hope you'll support our work financially. Please make your gift today at theworld.org/give or check out the link in the episode notes. Every gift helps us get closer to our goal. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you, and now the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. Meet Wise, one account for over 50 currencies, because today your life is bigger than one currency. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all in one account. With Wise, you can manage your money across borders cheaper, faster, and easier. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving, and try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
The Summit of the Americas, with a lot of absences, the leaders who are not in Los Angeles this week, their countries could pay a price.
For a country like Mexico, there's a very simple equation at play here. You either sit at the table or you're on the menu.
Looking hard for hemispheric unity. Also today in Afghanistan, if you are a musician, best to hide your instrument.
If the Taliban knows that we are musicians, it will be dangerous for all of us.
Musicians from Kabul were welcomed by Portugal, but they need new instruments and new homes. And Marvel's first Muslim superhero is an inspiration for many people. Even the trailer has big emotional energy.
Oh my God! That was awesome! Oh my God, I'm crying right now.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us this Monday. In Los Angeles today, the kickoff for the Summit of the Americas, a gathering that every 3 years brings together leaders from the Western Hemisphere. The U.S. is hosting for the first time since 1994. President Biden is expected to attend, along with Vice President Harris and Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Some key guests, though, will not be at the table, Mexico's president among them. To find out why, we reached out to Arturo Sarucan. He's a former Mexican ambassador to the U.S. and a columnist for Mexico's El Universal newspaper. He joins us from L.A. Ambassador Sarucan, Mexico is one of the most important countries in the world for the U.S. Why is President Andrés Manuel López Obrador not attending?
Well, Marco, that's a very good question, and there's a lot of speculation. My own sense is that he's been under a lot of pressure because of Mexico's support for migration control policies from the U.S., first with Trump and now with Biden. So this is sort of a way of signaling his, if you like it, independence vis-a-vis the U.S. Second, because people tend to forget he's a politician who cut his teeth in the 1970s, where the U.S.-Mexico relationship was extremely different from what it looks like today. Sort of remember it's the time of non-aligned movement and of Mexican foreign policy sort of using a playbook of sort of maintaining cordial relations with the U.S., but using Latin America policy, Cuba policy in particular, to sort of signal its distance and its ability to confront the U.S. for domestic and for regional purposes. However, there may be a more troubling reason, and that is that this decision came on the heels of his trip to Cuba a month and a half ago.
And what happened then?
I think Cuba asked Mexico for two things that Mexico could not provide, oil or money. So I think this was an easy way of saying, you know, I can't do this, but, you know, I'll stand up for you. So it may be a combination of these factors, plus the fact that he feels that he has sufficient leverage with the U.S. because of what he's doing on the migration front with the Biden administration, which, as you know well, Marco, is a key policy driver for the president and for the Democrats on the road to November and the U.S. midterms.
So it seems the United States has told Cuba, as well as Venezuela and Nicaragua, to stay away from the summit. So are you suggesting López Obrador is also bothered by Venezuela and Nicaragua not attending?
Yeah, absolutely. And my concern is twofold, Marco. Number one is that by articulating this position of having Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua attend, he is in many ways justifying, in the case of Nicaragua, the democratic erosion that is taking place, and in the case of Venezuela and Cuba, two authoritarian regimes. Now, we must recognize that there is a bit of a contradiction in the fact that the U.S. engages with other authoritarian regimes around the world and does not do so in this summit here in L.A. But at the end of the day, the U.S. is the host country. It decides who it invites and doesn't invite. I think the mechanism of the Summit of the Americas should be revisited. There's a joke in D.C. that those who work on the summits of the Americas are like cicadas. They go underground for 3 years and then they pop up and start working on summits of the Americas. It is not the most effective mechanism for interregional engagement. The other problem is that for a country like Mexico, there's a very simple equation at play here. You either sit at the table or you're on the menu.
So, Ambassador, I mean, what is the summit actually for? What does it accomplish?
Latin America and the Caribbean are plagued with summits and summitry. There are so many summits that at the end of the day, it looks like a mountain range. But having said this, the summit has been, in different moments, it's been sort of a bellwether of policy issues that are relevant and key to the Americas. This summit today and tomorrow and on Thursday in LA, one of those key drivers is how does this continent take on what are historical levels of people on the move in the continent? And it's not only on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's happening on the Venezuela-Colombia border. It's happening with Haitian refugees.
Well, as you know, Ambassador, President Biden says he wants the summit to produce a regional agreement on migration. I mean, what would a regional agreement on migration look like if it were to emerge from the summit?
The critical issue is going to be a series of standardized approaches to how we deal with everything from visa policy. Why is this relevant? Because the fact that some South American countries do not require a visa from certain nationals of countries, the fact that Cubans can fly to Nicaragua without a visa is what explains why we've had 1% of Cuba's total population moving through Mexico onto the border between Mexico and the United States. Or the fact that Haitians can fly into Chile or Argentina and from there move upwards towards the Darien Gap and then to the U.S.-Mexico border. How do we work to ensure that the countries are complying with their obligations to provide asylum and refugee policies? How are the countries engaging in successful integration policies? How do we think of refugee camps? Look at what's going on far away, but it's relevant, between how Poland has dealt with Ukrainian refugees, eliminating refugee camps on the border, dispersing them in urban centers, providing them with a temporary working permit. And look at how Mexico and the United States are dealing with the same phenomena on the U.S.-Mexico border, where we've got refugee encampments that are eroding support for an enlightened refugee policy. So I think that in many ways, the idea is that the summit provides a general blueprint for how the Americas need to co-responsibly address what are these historic levels of people on the move in the Americas that we had never seen before.
So Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua won't be at the summit. There are other attendees in doubt. If they don't come, what can legitimately be accomplished if these countries are absent?
Well, it's certainly going to be a slap in the face of the U.S., and there's no doubt, Marco, that there may have been some miscalculations in how the prepping for the summit took place. It could play domestically into the hands of Republicans heading into the midterms by underscoring that the president was unable to convene a summit in the United States. And it will most likely play into the hands of China, that must be rubbing its hands at this, because of the important inroads that China has been making in terms of not only investment, infrastructure, but also public diplomacy and soft power projection in the region. And so there's also geopolitical context to how this might play out in the coming weeks and years.
Arturo Sarucan served as Mexico's ambassador to the U.S. from 2007 to 2013. He joined us from Los Angeles, the setting for the Summit of the Americas this week. Thank you very much, Ambassador. Always good to speak with you.
It's great to be with you, Marco. Thank you.
Under Taliban rule in Afghanistan, music is now banned. Just being a musician can put your life at risk. In December, Portugal opened its doors to nearly 300 Afghans, all of them affiliated with the Afghanistan National Institute of Music, Kabul's only music academy. But as Francesca Berardi reports from a refugee center outside of Lisbon, some of the musicians now feel stranded.
In mid-December, Portugal celebrated the arrival of Afghan musicians and some of their family members to Lisbon. The head of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music, or ANIM, spoke to the Portuguese press.
In Portugal, alunos, professores e famílias chegaram a Lisboa.
He says, "We are here to have a good life. We came with an important mission, to preserve Afghan music for the future." But 6 months later, that future remains very unclear. Huma Raimi plays a sitar on the terrace of a refugee center outside Lisbon. It's the Centro de Acolhimento para Refugiados, a facility now hosting people fleeing war and violence from 7 different countries. The music mingles with the sounds of surrounding industrial plants and the wind blowing off the Tejo River. Rahimi is 24 years old and a member of the Zora Orchestra, Afghanistan's only female music ensemble. She's also a teacher at ANIM.
When I came from Afghanistan, I didn't bring my sitar because it was difficult, and if the Taliban knows that we are musicians, it will be dangerous for all of us.
ANIM's director was able to find her a new sitar from London. She doesn't love the way it sounds, but she uses it to teach students staying at another refugee center. She's hoping the school will reopen in Portugal and that she will be able to continue teaching there. She's eager to build a new life away from war.
It's difficult to come somewhere that you don't know the language, the culture, and you don't have anything here. But I'm glad that I'm safe here, and I'm trying to be positive and work hard to see my future. I believe in myself.
Other refugees are finding it harder to stay positive. Jamal Hashemi is a pianist and composer and another member of ANIM. He's 30 years old and says he never stops thinking about the family he had to leave behind in Kabul.
My family, they are in danger. You know, I'm afraid to call my wife, really. When I call to them, I start crying and do something like this. I say, oh my God, what should I do?
Hashemi has been waiting for months to receive the residency paper he needs to apply for reunification with his family. And while waiting, he tries to help them remotely. He sends them most of the monthly pocket money he receives from the center, 150 euros meant to be used for food, telephone and transportation. The refugee center is in a remote location, but his priority is to save money, so he rarely leaves.
I'm just thinking about my future. What should I do for my family? How I can earn money? Really, I can't see the beauty of Portugal now. Because I don't care. My mind is just thinking about my future. I'm worried about that.
He tells me about one group trip he took to Nazaré, a seaside village north of Lisbon. It was organized by the center.
It's my first time that I see oceans. But I'm completely, I was without any emotional. So I have water. Yeah, good, very good, very nice.
The one thing that has brought Hashemi a little bit of hope is connecting with local musicians who reached out to members of ANIM and invite them to play. One of them made a video of a recent jam session at a local bar. The musicians were from all over the world, and it made Hashemi think that he could maybe one day open an artist association in Portugal, similar to the one he founded in Kabul. One of the musicians he met in Lisbon gave him a piano. His own piano remains in Kabul, hidden in the back of his parents' house under a mountain of bags filled with garbage. The new piano sits in the corner of his room, a small space he shares with a refugee from another country. While his roommate is out, Hashemi plays. It's the one thing that reminds him who he is. And even here, still makes him feel at home. For the World, I'm Francesca Berardi, in Lisbon.
Coming up on the show, the actor who is Marvel's newest star and how she became a teenage Muslim trailblazer. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Intense fighting continues in the eastern part of Ukraine. Russia is trying to take control of the city of Severodonetsk. It's where, over the weekend, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, visited troops on the front lines and met with families being evacuated. Chris Doherty is following the latest. He's with the defense program at the Center for a New American Security. So one of the places, Chris, that Zelensky visited was Lysychansk, a town right across the river from Severodonetsk, where a lot of fighting is happening. What is the latest there?
What you see right now is a little bit of a Ukrainian pushback after what appeared to be about weeks of Russian advances into Severodonetsk, and they're very clearly fixating on that as part of their overall push to take the rest of the Donetsk province. And I think what really concerns me right now, as I look at the Ukrainian position, is less what's happening in Severodonetsk itself and more what's happening on what are the shoulders of what is increasingly a fairly pronounced salient of Ukrainian forces pushing into Severodonetsk. I think what we're seeing right now is this very intense fires battle and a very attritional fight. And I really, really hope that the Ukrainians can hold out, but their position looks a little tenuous to me.
So this is basic military strategy. Can you describe the geography and terrain around Severodonetsk and how that impacts the way both Russian and Ukrainian forces are fighting?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, there's a river that runs through it. And as we've seen throughout this war, but more broadly throughout military history, crossing a river under attack is extremely difficult because there's nowhere to hide on a river. They know where you're going, they know where you're trying to go, and you're under observation and fire the entire time. And one of the things I think we're seeing in this war that's interesting is the amount of intelligence and surveillance that's taking place in this theater is quite significant, both on the Russian and on the Ukrainian side, and the Ukrainian side, much of it being supplied by Western allies like the United States. It means it's really hard for either side to gain what we might consider an operational surprise necessary to conduct a successful river crossing or a successful maneuver like that. And so you see this much more static, grinding, attritional warfare with firepower where neither side could really gain a substantial advantage and surprise the other and create what we would call a breakthrough.
And where could that lead?
I think it leads to a fight that looks like the end phases of a lot of modern wars, wherein both sides lose their ability to surprise each other, whether they're running low on people or whether they've just sort of become so tightly entangled with each other. And those wars tend to devolve into very attritional, firepower-centric slogs, where each side is really just hammering away on the other. Neither side can really break the other one's will or break through their lines. And so it's just a lot of fighting and dying and casualties on both sides. And I'm thinking here of the last year and a half of the Korean War in U.S. history, or the very end of the U.S. Civil War as Grant was surrounding Lee's forces in and around Richmond, you know, the later phases of the Iran-Iraq War. There's a whole host of wars that have sort of devolved into this very firepower-centric attritional warfare. And I think that's probably what you're going to see in and around places like Severodonetsk as we go forward.
So you're using, Chris, war's ends as kind of analogies here, as markers in this 100-plus days of this Russian war in Ukraine. How significant are these battles?
These are the biggest battles, clearly, that we've seen in Europe since World War II, or perhaps some phases of the breakup of the Balkans. So these are pretty significant battles. I mean, they're significant-sized forces. We're talking about battles of in the thousands to tens of thousands, which is a large, significant fight. And what you're also seeing, I think that's different for people who've probably studied military history, is this is a lot more like the wars we've seen over the last 50 or 60 years, where it's nonstop, constant fighting and constant attrition. It's really, really difficult for forces to hold up under. And I think that's really the question that we'll see. And this could go on for weeks, it could go on for months, but really the question is which side can endure this level of pain, this level of casualties, and sustain operations before saying, you know what, enough is enough, let's go to the negotiating table because this isn't worth it for me anymore.
Chris, let me ask you finally about morale, because we saw the images of President Zelensky visiting troops on the front lines. What kind of a difference does that actually make during wartime?
Oh boy, that's like the $64,000 question. There have been lots of studies. My personal opinion is that it does matter. The motivational aspect of having a leader who is demonstrating courage under fire, who's demonstrating a willingness to go through the privations that the soldiers fighting on the front line are also going through, and a willingness to put himself in a bit of danger, but also his charismatic persona. You know, I don't know that we've seen it, at least in the Western world, since perhaps Churchill, right? But he really is, you know, I mean, whether it's his acting background or it's just innate personal charisma, that change in belief and that change in narrative are powerful forces. Whether that's supported by the academic literature, I'm not totally sure, but I certainly do believe it anyway. It's sort of a core belief.
Chris Doherty is a senior fellow for the defense program at the Center for a New American Security, speaking with us about the latest in Russia's war against Ukraine. Chris, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
The last day of high school is always memorable. For Iman Vellani in Markham, Ontario, it was a day that completely changed her life. The World's Bianca Hillier has a story about what happened when Hollywood came calling.
Vellani was sitting in her friend's driveway when her phone pinged. Someone from the Marvel Cinematic Universe was asking her to join a Zoom meeting. Turns out, Kevin Feige, president of Marvel Studios, was on the line with a message.
You want me to do it?
Yeah.
Come on, you did amazing work. You've done amazing work, and we'd be honored if you would play Kamala Khan for us in the Miss Marvel show. And it was a unanimous decision.
Oh, my God.
Vellani said she wasn't able to comprehend the fact that she'd landed the role of Kamala Khan, the lead character in Marvel's upcoming Disney Plus show called Miss Marvel. Vellani, now 19, has little to no acting experience. But when she heard about the casting call, it felt like fate. She's a huge Miss Marvel fan, as she explained to Toronto's Now magazine.
I read all of the comics when I was in high school. I dressed up as her for Halloween, and so she was very much a prominent, you know, character in my life.
In fact, acting chops weren't necessary in this case. Vellani herself is remarkably similar to her character. Kamala Khan is the first Muslim superhero in Marvel history.
It's not really the brown girls from Jersey City who saved the world.
In the show, Khan struggles to fit in at school. Her parents immigrated from Pakistan, just like Vellani's parents did in real life. Vellani says growing up in Canada, she felt pretty disconnected from her culture, in part because she didn't see anyone like herself on screen.
Being brown in Hollywood never really went hand in hand. I never saw myself represented in that light, so I felt like, okay, I can't be myself if I want to be a part of this world.
But on the red carpet at the show's Toronto premiere, Vellani talked about being the change she has always wanted to see.
Film and TV literally shape how we see people in this world. And so, you know, when you're only representing Muslims in a certain type of light, it gets very one note. And I'm so glad that Marvel's providing space for a character like Kamala to exist and to just take up space.
Vellani adds that, importantly, being Muslim isn't Khan's entire life. She's a powerful superhero who just happens to be Pakistani and Muslim. That story is already striking a chord.
That was awesome! Oh my God, I'm crying right now.
Muslim fans are posting reaction videos to the trailer on YouTube.
Oh my God, that's her, that's Kamala.
Okay, I like that. It felt heartwarming.
The much-anticipated Miss Marvel show premieres on Disney Plus on June 8th. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
There's war in Central Europe. Authoritarianism is on the rise.
It's really just because of many, many small decisions, small characters acting in narrow and self-interested ways that ultimately bring about the end of the world.
Don't worry, it's science fiction. Still, the parallels between a Czech novel from the 30s and today are eerie. Ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It was another weekend of senseless gun violence here in the U.S., but also in Nigeria, with a scene sadly reminiscent of some events in America. Four gunmen opened fire on people attending a Catholic church service southwest of Nigeria's main city, Lagos. At least 50 people were killed. Philip Obagi joins us now to tell us more. He's a correspondent for The Daily Beast and based in Lagos. What exactly happened in this attack, Philip? What do we know so far?
Well, it all occurred on Sunday at about 15 minutes past 11 when about four gunmen drove in a vehicle. These gunmen were armed with AK-47s, and then they also had explosives with them, and they began to open fire. Some people, like those who were selling just in front of the church, the people on bicycles selling ice creams, were gunned down. And then in trying to gain entry into the church, the terrorists had to, you know, blow the door using the explosives they had in them. We're told that one eyewitness said the priest asked the church members to lock the doors of the church when they began to hear gunshots, and they began to shoot at everyone they saw. So in all, about 50 people were killed. The Catholic priest in charge of the church was lucky to escape. And then there were so many people, dozens of people wounded, were currently receiving treatment at a local hospital.
I mean, this was a chaotic and bloody scene. Who were the gunmen, and do we know anything about their motivations?
Well, it's so hard to say exactly who they are, but we do know that, you know, in the last couple of years, the suburbs of Nigeria have been seeing an incursion of Fulani militias. Fulani is one of the dominant ethnic groups in northern Nigeria. In fact, this group, it's a nomadic group. You find the Fulanis, you know, in many parts of the Sahel. You know, they are in Niger, in Guinea, in Cameroon, you know, also in Burkina Faso. But a lot of the violence that we have witnessed in the North Central and even in the Northwest have been blamed on cattle rearers from this ethnic group. It will not be surprising if this is another attack that is being done by this particular group.
I mean, the Fulani people have often been blamed for the violence, but we also know that mistakes have been made, and it's often not the Fulani. I mean, some analysts I know are saying this attack on the church was a failure of intelligence. Why are they saying that?
A lot of times when attacks of this nature occur, people are always saying that, you know, the intelligence agencies have failed. But again, in many ways, that's true, because Nigeria in the last 6-7 years has been facing high-level insecurity everywhere, not just in the Northeast where we knew or where we've always known Boko Haram to operate, or even in the Northwest where banditry, you know, has been growing. It's a case of the economic reality of Nigeria taking its toll, effect of, you know, a dwindling economy, massive unemployment, you know, disparity between the rich and poor, you know, growing sporadically.
What is the government in Abuja actually doing to turn all this violence around?
We hear the government saying, well, the security agencies are on top of it. But it's one attack too many. A lot of these attacks are not even reported in the media. Even if they are, you know, they just end, you know, in the Nigerian, you know, media space. The entire world is unaware of exactly the level of insecurity, the level of killings, the level of attacks taking place in many areas in Nigeria, particularly in the north.
So regardless of who actually committed this attack and what their motivations were, you would say it's noteworthy that this attack happened in the southern part of Nigeria.
That's right. That's right. And that's the reason why, you know, it's gained a lot of, you know, attention, you know, a lot of condemnation and also a lot of agitation, you know, a lot of anger too. Of course, this is an attack on Christians. So there's always going to be a feeling that the culprits were actually people from the other religion, from the Islamic religion.
Yeah, even though we still are unclear about what the motive was in this attack, the very fact that it was an attack on a church, I mean, what kind of impact will that have on the already fragile Muslim-Christian relations in Nigeria?
Users of social media already said, well, we don't want this country to remain the way it is. Let's have a division. You know, let the Muslim not separate from the Christian South. So it's only going to make things worse. Nigeria is already so fragile, so divided along religious lines first, and then also along ethnic lines.
Philip, the U.S. has seen an outrageous number of mass shootings, and that results in a national conversation about guns, which, after multiple tragic attacks, is happening right now again. Do events like this church attack in Nigeria prompt a conversation there about guns?
Unlike in the U.S., the issue we have in Africa is not about, you know, gun control. because a lot of times when you see shootings in Africa, they've been done by terrorist group who, you know, in one way or the other have been able to lay their hands on weapons. You know, it's not about having the license to own a gun. You know, it's about terrorists somehow, you know, smuggling guns into the country and then begin to use these guns and whatever other weapons they have to cause havoc.
Philip Obagi is the Nigeria correspondent for The Daily Beast. He's been speaking with us from Lagos, where he's been covering the attack on a church in the town of Owo, which left 50 people dead. Philip, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marco. Always a pleasure.
The Best Actress Award at this year's Cannes Film Festival went to Zahr Amir Ibrahimi. She starred in Holy Spider, a dark story based on true events that happened in Iran. Amir Ibrahimi grew up in Iran and started her acting career there, but after getting caught up in a high-profile sex scandal, she left the country and has lived in exile in France. Now, as we hear from the world's Shirin Jafari, the actress is back in the limelight.
Zahr Amir Ibrahimi was a star in her early 20s. She had a role in one of Iran's longest-running TV series. But a scandal in 2006 almost ended her acting career. A video posted online allegedly showed Amir Ibrahimi having sex with her partner. In conservative Iran, this was hugely controversial. Amir Ibrahimi later told the British newspaper The Guardian that her ex-fiancé released the video after she ended their relationship. Amir Ibrahimi fled to France and 16 years later, she played the lead role in the film Holy Spider. It's a gruesome story in which Amir Ibrahimi plays a journalist trying to solve a series of murders in the holy city of Mashhad in northeastern Iran. It's based on a true story that took place just over 20 years ago. A man called Saeed Hanayi killed at least 16 women, sex workers, in one of Iran's most conservative cities. The murders became known as the spider killings because Hanayi lured the women into his home and strangled them there. Roya Karimi Majd was a reporter at the time and she covered the story. These murders drew a lot of attention, she tells me. After every killing, Hanayi would call the local newspaper and report the location of his victim's body. This terrified people, Match says. The fact that someone could go around and kill so many women and then reveal the location of his victims. Karimi Majd followed the story for months, and eventually she and a colleague made a documentary film about the murders. In one scene, she actually sits down to question the serial killer. He's wearing a grey prison outfit, has salt and pepper beard, and seems eerily calm. I asked Majd what that was like. I had so many questions for him, she tells me. I wanted to know if he was acting alone. I suspected that he had some sort of help. Shortly after that interview, Saeed Hanayi was executed. Case closed. But now the story is getting attention again with the film Holy Spider. Karimi Majd says she sees herself in the role that Zahr Amir Ibrahimi plays in the movie. The filmmakers consulted with Majd and she says she's impressed with how it turned out. I'm so happy that Amir Ibrahimi won the prize at Cannes, Karimi Majd says. This is a huge achievement for Iranian women. At the ceremony, Amir Ibrahimi gave a long, passionate speech that was translated into French.
Tonight, I have came along.
She said cinema helped her get through tough times. At moments when she felt humiliated, exiled, and lonely, it was cinema that saved her, she said. She said, they thought they could delete me, but here I am. Since the news of her award at Cannes, Amir Ibrahimi has come under renewed attacks from inside Iran. Officials there are calling the movie disgusting and insulting to Shiite Muslims. Holy Spider will be released in France next month. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In the wake of World War II, much of Europe was in ruins. The European Recovery Program, better known as the Marshall Plan, was the U.S. answer to how to get the continent back on its feet.
Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos.
That's Secretary of State George C. Marshall speaking 75 years ago Sunday, unveiling his namesake plan to rebuild Europe. Now we're watching the destruction in another European war in Ukraine. World leaders from Volodymyr Zelensky to Boris Johnson have suggested a new Marshall Plan, one that would rebuild Ukraine and bolster the solidarity of the Western allies. We want to examine the comparison being drawn here, so we turn to Ben Steele. He's the director of international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War. So, Ben, the price tag of the Marshall Plan, $160 billion in today's money, and that went to helping countries, including Germany, rebuild. And Germany, of course, started the war. What was the motivation for this kind of investment?
It was really preventing Soviet expansionism, particularly into Central and Western Europe. It had been American policy in the immediate aftermath of the war to deindustrialize Germany and dismember it. But that was clearly shown to be in the Soviet interest because the very slow recovery of Western Germany was dragging down the entire recovery of Western Europe. So the United States made it a centerpiece of the Marshall Plan to rehabilitate the country, reindustrialize it, ramp up its production as fast as possible.
So when people talk about a Marshall Plan for Ukraine, what are they really proposing?
Well, they're proposing massive rehabilitation aid, reconstruction aid, and this is certainly a worthy aim to pursue. But when they use the analogy of the Marshall Plan, what they're trying to suggest is that somehow this aid can have the sort of remarkable economic and political effect that it had in the case of the 16 Marshall countries between 1948 and 1952. I, however, think that this is entirely unrealistic. In the situation Ukraine faces, we can be sure that if the United States and its allies use reconstruction aid as a means of cementing Kiev into a Western alliance, that Putin will undertake very determined efforts to make sure that that aid is not effective.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, you've pointed out in the past that NATO was critical to the success of the Marshall Plan, and the war in Ukraine seems to have solidified NATO. What a massive effort to help Ukraine rebuild, further strengthen the alliance or weaken it.
Well, as you know, one of Russia's primary war aims is to ensure that Ukraine never becomes part of NATO. That security element, NATO, was critical to the success of the Marshall Plan. And you can see previous recent economic reconstruction efforts in which the United States was totally unsuccessful because it wasn't able to provide that security element. Take Iraq and Afghanistan, where the United States committed $210 billion in reconstruction aid alone. That's $50 billion more than the total Marshall allocations in current dollars. Yet we have virtually nothing to show for that money. And the reason is that we were unable to provide the necessary internal and external security to these countries that would have allowed them to use that money effectively.
What's the price tag here? How much money are we talking about? What could a Ukraine Marshall-style plan cost?
Well, if we're just talking about basic reconstruction, I mean, we're all already up to probably something in excess of $60 billion. These are major sums. There's no doubt that there are good humanitarian and political reasons for pursuing them, but we do have to be realistic about this. We are not going to see any sort of economic or political renaissance in Ukraine unless Russia cooperates to some degree. That is, it doesn't actively try to undermine the effectiveness of this aid, which is it is capable of doing. One of the reasons that we consider the Marshall Plan so successful today was the fact that the Truman administration was so realistic about setting the boundaries of the Marshall Plan and only seeking to aid those countries which it felt it could protect.
So, Ben, from the war in Ukraine to climate change, the idea of a Marshall Plan to solve problems is one that people seem to really turn to. Is it helpful to understand what the needs of these major crises that we face really are?
Well, climate change, no doubt, is a challenge that has to be addressed from a global perspective, and it is going to involve an enormous amount of money. But I think the mistake we make in using the Marshall Plan analogy is to assume that it was the enormous amount of government money that was poured into Europe that really drove the economic rehabilitation of the continent. My basic argument is that we should not simply assume that the Marshall Plan is all about spending enormous sums of money, even though such sums will be necessary to address a problem like climate change. The most important component is political will and solidarity among the countries that are participating.
Ben Steele is Director of International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War. Ben, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
There is tension in Central Europe, authoritarianism is on the rise, and the very future of the planet is uncertain. That could describe today, but I'm actually referring to the 1930s and a science fiction Czech novel, War with the Newts. Newts are those semi-aquatic amphibians that look like a cross between a frog and a lizard. Podcast producer Ian Koss was inspired by the 1930s novel, and Koss's new audio drama from PRX called Newts drops tomorrow. Ian, your podcast is based on the science fiction story involving humans and newts. What was this book about?
Yeah, it's a pretty wild story. And to me, it's especially wild when you consider that, you know, this is written in 1935, 1936 in Czechoslovakia on the eve of World War II. All this is going on. And this Czech novelist, Karel Čapek, sits down and has this idea. What if, amidst all this, humanity encounters this species of highly intelligent newts? And so that's how the story begins, with a sea captain sailing to the East Indies and on this small island coming across this 3-foot-tall, kind of slimy creature.
Show yourself! Well, that ain't no devil. That's a newt.
So at first, the captain is kind of drawn to the newts almost like children. He's very protective of them. But soon he realizes just how smart they are, that they can learn to use a knife, that they can use tools. And the whole story kind of spirals from there. These newts are put to work. They're exploited as laborers. They're entertainers. And the whole thing kind of builds and builds and builds until the newts learn so much about being human that they start to turn on us and aren't so sure that they need us anymore. And that's where the story kind of gets dark.
Wow. So I want to get to what it all means. But tell us first about the author of War with the Newts, Karel Čapek. I know he was a very famous Czech writer. What else is important about Čapek?
War with the Newts is published in 1936, but this is really one of his final works. Čapek really came into his own as a writer right after World War I, in this incredible period between World War I and World War II, when Czechoslovakia was an independent, democratic nation, and there was this flowering of culture and art. He had his breakout moment sort of in 1920 when he published a play called Rossum's Universal Robots. And that's actually where the term robot comes from in English and other languages, is from this play. And that play actually made him something of an international literary figure. He was invited to London to speak at a conference of PEN, the International Literary Organization. He was later nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature. So he really had a pretty high status in the literary world and was quite famous. But since his death, his work has been largely kind of overlooked or forgotten in the English-speaking world, at least.
So, Ian, I know your podcast is an audio drama and not a film, but visualize newts for us. I mean, what do they actually look like?
They're about 3 feet tall, 3 to 4 feet tall. They're kind of slimy, icky, and gooey all over. They have very good manual dexterity. They have agile little hands or paws that can manipulate tools and objects and technology. And very importantly, they have vocal folds that allow them to talk, which is one of the big turning points in the story when humans first realize that these newts are capable of language.
What was that?
What's that?
Oh, you can talk.
You can talk?
Well, blimey, can you, Adam and Eve? Go on then. Say, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Wow, I'm kind of feeling a HAL 9000 computer there from 2001. I mean, it feels part Kafka, part George Orwell. What inspired this particular story, and what does it mean that in this time, newts overtake the globe but then are subjugated by humans?
It's an interesting book because it's tempting, given the circumstances under which it was written, to read it as a direct allegory, to say, oh, okay, the newts must represent fascism, that this is a direct kind of reflection on the times it was created. But it doesn't really work like that. There are moments when the newts can sort of be seen as a symbol of fascism or even communism. But really, at the end of the day, the newts are newts, and they follow their own kind of slippery internal logic. To me, it speaks just as clearly as a kind of ecological commentary, you know, to our own times of living in an era of climate change. It raises questions about the ethics of artificial intelligence. There's this way in which the story speaks so broadly to many different issues because it isn't attempting to kind of capture the politics of a single moment. One way to think about the newts is, in this book, they really function as a kind of mirror on humanity. You know, if the newts are evil, then they're no more or less evil than we are. I mean, one of the charming things about them is even as the newts are bringing about the end of the world and humanity as we know it, they're kind of relentlessly cheerful about the whole thing and friendly. And that's something that we tried to capture in the podcast as well, that even as the newts are bringing about the end of the world and humanity as we know it, they're kind of relentlessly cheerful about it, which you can hear in this clip from Chief Salamander, the leader of the newts, as he's sort of announcing to humanity that they are, in fact, responsible for flooding the continents.
What?
Hello? Hello? Chief Salamander, hello speaking. I know you're probably wondering what's going on with all these floods and earthquakes. I'm afraid it was us.
What?
Please accept this message of explanation.
Again, that's Chief Salamander announcing to the world that, yeah, sorry, it was us. If you think about what these newts represent, I mean, another intelligent species that we can commune with and engage with and collaborate with on our own planet, and yet humanity manages to just totally muck it up. And it's not because of some evil, conniving villain. It's really just because of many, many small decisions, small characters acting in narrow and self-interested ways that ultimately bring about the end of the world.
So I want to come back to the author of War with the Newts, Carl Čapek. What happened to him?
So Čapek died on Christmas Day in 1938, 2 months after Germany invaded Czechoslovakia. He had been unwell and developed pneumonia. I read an account of this by a friend of Čapek's and a doctor who wrote that, yes, in a technical sense, he died of pneumonia. But in another sense, his body just kind of gave up on living, that he was so crushed by what he saw as the betrayal of his country by the West, and that he never really recovered from that.
Ian Koss is co-creator of Newts, a new audio drama from PRX inspired by the science fiction novel by Czech writer Karel Čapek. You can find the podcast by searching for Newts PRX wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about your project.
Thank you, Marco.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're also online for you anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Before we go, this is Marco, here to remind you that from now through June 30th, we're asking listeners to support our work. Thanks to your generosity, our journalism remains independent and accessible to all. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making your gift today at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.